Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello. This is Simon Brill. I'm the editor of Film Stories. And my life, what's going on there? Well, a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. Guess what one of the two films I'm doing this episode is?
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, title gives it away. I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I tend to talk about all sorts, really. Development stories, marketing stories, release stories, production stories. All the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to choose this podcast, they're more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I do try not to do snark. I do try not to punch down. I think there's quite a lot of that out there already, isn't there? Instead, I'm just celebrating the fact that it's really hard to make a film. And these are some of the people and the stories of films actually being made. Without further ado, I'm going to crack on with the first of the two films I'm covering in this episode. I'm taking you back to 1992 for this one. I'll play you a clip. You might have heard this one.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Well, crikey, I only asked. That was a clip from 1992's, of course, A Few Good Men, directed by Rob Reiner. Screenplay for this one by Aaron Sorkin, based on his own play. The cast led by Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson, Demi Moore, Kevin Bacon, Kevin Pollak, James Marshall, J.T. Walsh, Kiefer Sutherland. An extraordinary ensemble for this one. And, well, the story of it, I mean, it's worth noting, at the point this story begins, that Tom Cruise wasn't the box office gold that he would go on to become for most of the 1990s, that this was a period in his career where things hadn't quite gone to plan, that 1990's Days of Thunder, for instance, was expected to do Top Gun numbers again and to have the cultural impact of Top Gun, given it was a reunion of the Top Gun team. However, the bloated production, which I'll come to in a future episode of Film Stories, was one of those where the behind the scenes of the movie was probably more interesting than what we actually got on screen. The movie underperformed at the box office in the summer of 1990. Cruise also then in 1992 released Far and Away, directed by Ron Howard, co-starring Nicole Kidman. That was the film in which he tried an Irish accent. Some really sweeping moments in the movie as well, but that one fizzled a bit as well. It's not that these films were doing badly, it's just they weren't doing the level of performance that was expected really from a movie star project at this point. As it would turn out, though, for his next film after that, he would pick a film that would kickstart an extraordinary run of box office success. And that film was indeed A Few Good Men. Good job, really, given that I'm talking about it. Now, the story of this particular movie goes back to 1988, where a 27-year-old, pretty much unknown playwright by that time, by the name of Aaron Sorkin, was writing. And he had a phone call with his sister, Deborah. Now, Deborah had joined the Navy Corps after graduating from law school. And one day on the phone, she told her brother a story about something called a hazing that was taking place within the Marines, allegedly taking place within the Marines, to be clear. And as Sorkin explained to Empire magazine in its February 1993 issue, a hazing, also known as a code red at the Guantanamo Bay US naval base in Cuba, had gone wrong. Now, it hadn't gone as wrong as it would come across in the film, but I'll come to that shortly. Sorkin at this point was making ends meet by working primarily as a bartender on Broadway at the Palace Theatre. I think Le Cage au Folle was playing, The Birdcage. That would go on to become the film The Birdcage, of course, which I'll come to in a future episode. And during downtime at that job, he started scribbling notes down and bits of the story down on napkins. And again, as he said to Empire, as I started working on it, the incident itself became less relevant to what the story was, and the focus became this guy who was apolitical and passionless, who develops a sense of patriotism and passion about his work. Sorkin would scribble more and more and more notes. He would go home, he'd type them into a rickety old computer. And as he wrote, he beefed up the seriousness of the Code Red incident that sits at the heart of A Few Good Men. And in his story, unlike the real life event, it led to a death, which then in turn kickstarts a court case. Now, Sorkin, even though he was pretty much unknown, he had had a success at this point. He'd done a one-act play called Hidden in This Picture, which had earned him some coverage in the New York Times. Now, one of the many people reading the New York Times and the coverage of its theatre scene was a producer by the name of David Brown. David Brown was one of those responsible for films such as The Sting and Jaws. And he got in touch with Sorkin and they got chatting and he learned about A Few Good Men. And David Brown picked up the screen rights to the play even before rehearsals had started on it. As Time magazine reported in an issue in 1989, the play had sold before that first rehearsal and put six figures into Aaron Sorkin's bank account. Now, it's worth noting Tom Hulce of Amadeus fame, who's also one of the co-stars of The Brilliant Parenthood, was in the lead role for the Broadway show. But even before the opening, this had built up a head of steam. Here was this young playwright, this this bright new thing who got six figures in his back pocket, and now the play is coming out, and it became a great big hyped Broadway production, and that it would open on Broadway in 1999. It's worth noting, just contextually, politically, this was before Guantanamo Bay became as contentious as it was, as it would become in culture in the years that followed. A Few Good Men opened at the Music Box Theatre on Broadway. In the end, it would run for nearly 500 performances, seen by an awful lot of people, one or two important ones too, who I'm coming to shortly. Now, there was some initial backlash, given inevitably it'd been hyped up as, you know, the thing from this bright new thing, and the profile that it had earned off the back of Sorkin's deal. But even though there was a bit of sniffiness at first, the play still hit, and it still played for over a year. Now, Sorkin was also keen to break into screenwriting, and the script for A Few Good Men ended up at Castle Rock Entertainment as a writing sample. Now, Castle Rock Entertainment was co-founded by Rob Reiner, who was going through, a director, Rob Reiner, who's going through an extraordinary run of success himself, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, The Princess Bride, and he'd set up Castle Rock Entertainment to buy himself a bit of independence and protection from the studio system. The readers there saw something in A Few Good Men, and Reiner got in touch with Sorkin and asked him to work on a script for a thriller Castle Rock was developing called Damages, that would go on to be ultimately be called Malice. Alec Baldwin would star it, I think Nicole Kidman as well, directed by Harold Becker even. But separately, I mean, while Reiner was working with Sorkin, he got interested again in A Few Good Men. Now, the rights to the play at this point that David Brown had optioned, they'd been set up at TriStar Pictures, and executives at TriStar, well, they were pushing back on the script for the play. One of the things in particular that executives at TriStar were looking at was a relationship between two of the lead characters in the film. Now, the two lead attorneys in the movie are the character of Daniel Caffey and the character of Lieutenant Commander Joanne Galloway. And in the script, what TriStar executives were suggesting was that those two, well, they needed to have a sex scene in the middle of this courtroom drama. Not actually in the middle of the court, I'd imagine, but, you know, this was going to be a Hollywood production. It was inevitably going to have a high-profile male lead, a high-profile female lead, and what rumpy-pumpy was surely required. Sorkin, at this stage in his career, was pretty powerless to do much about that as well. He didn't have currency in Hollywood. He was the new person in. He really wasn't happy with the changes that would be made to his story. But what could he do, as the executives kept sending in the notes? It wasn't even that TriStar wanted a romance between Caffey and Galloway. They just wanted a bit of humping. And so, the studio note reportedly read, "Why is Joe a woman? She doesn't take her top off, and there's no love scene." Now, what reversed some of these suggestions was the increased involvement of Rob Reiner, because he got intrigued enough about A Few Good Men as the work was continuing on Malice to ask, well, what's actually happening with this play? He was working, in fact, I think he was just finishing up making his latest film, Misery, at the time, and I've covered that on a previous podcast. And he asked TriStar if the studio fancied selling it to Castle Rock. Well, TriStar was still relatively keen to hold on to it, but then Reiner went off to see the play while it was playing on Broadway, and off the back of that, he knew he wanted to direct it. It wasn't just he wanted it with his company, he wanted it to be his next film. TriStar all of a sudden had a project that one of Hollywood's hottest directors was interested in. Reiner was attracted by the story of a son being in the shadow of his father, and that talked to him really, because, I mean, his own Hollywood story is he's the son of the late great Carl Reiner, director of really, really wonderful films like All of Me and The Jerk and The Man with Two Brains. What a film that is. And so he was used to being the person who lived in his father's shadow until really he stepped out of it once and for all, really, with Stand By Me. And again, what a film that was. What this meant was that pretty soon the project was set up as a Castle Rock project, that Reiner was going to direct it, and now Rob Reiner, an A-list Hollywood director at this point, was firmly in Aaron Sorkin's orbit and vice versa. Now, to Reiner's credit, straight away, the humping, well, that can go. Didn't want any of that. But he did still want changes, and he did still want to work with Sorkin to shape the script and turn it into a film. Now, Sorkin was used to working on his screenplays alone. He'd written the play by himself. And now he found himself in regular contact with Rob Reiner. And again, let's go back to that Empire interview. Sorkin would admit it was a rough first week. He said, I felt like someone was in my house rearranging the furniture. He'll call you in the middle of the night and start talking. The next thing you know, we've spent a whole trucking week. I might have altered what he said there, on one line on page 37. It was a tough new experience for him, and Reiner was forceful on story. He wanted these things to be right, but the two eventually found a way to click and get along. And also, it's worth noting that the involvement of Castle Rock gave the film, the project, the creative freedom, really, it needed, not just to push back on some of the nonsense, but also that Sorkin and Reiner could shape the kind of film, really, they wanted to make. This was heading towards, and again, at the time, this was expensive, particularly for a film with no action and special effects, around a $30, $40 million budget. And yet, there was still that kind of cloak of protection given by who was actually making it. That cloak of protection was afforded even more when a star came along, and that was Tom Cruise, first aboard the project. He was sounded out to see if he was interested. Yes, he was interested before he would sign on the dotted line to take on one of the lead roles of Daniel Caffey. He would insist on seeing the play on Broadway first, which he duly did and loved it. He threw himself then fairly promptly into the role. He learned all the legal jargon required for his character, and he became a collaborator on it with Reiner in bringing the project together. What that meant is Cruise had some, I mean, he was at least scouted out or talked to about some of the casting options for the movie. And there was the elephant in the room, really, was who on earth do you cast in the role of Colonel Nathan Jessup? A pivotal character in the movie. Now, it was, there were, again, a couple of names. Gene Hackman was reportedly one possible candidate for this, but Hackman was committed to making the film Unforgiven for Clint Eastwood, a very wise choice as well. I love that film as well. But it was Jack Nicholson who, I mean, you can't imagine anyone else now. He didn't actually come into the frame for this one until Reiner saw him at a basketball match, and he went to Castle Rock's offices the next day, Reiner, not Nicholson, and went back through the script for A Few Good Men, reading the lines of Jessup in Nicholson's voice. Reiner does have acting credentials, it's worth noting. And so at that point, it just seemed logical. This is the person we need. An offer went in. Nicholson was known for taking his time considering these roles, but eventually signed on the dotted line. And again, that was really the moment, I think, where this project was launched into the stratosphere, that Cruise was a star, perhaps not a mega star at this point. Jack Nicholson certainly was. The two of them in the film together, well, box office gold, surely. And the star power wasn't done. It's worth noting, too, that Nicholson landed a tasty post-Batman-esque deal, not size of that deal, for his work. It's very well known, I think, that the deal he got for making 1989's Batman, where he played the Joker, made him the best part of $100 million in the end, given all the add-ons that were built into it. In the case of A Few Good Men, it wasn't quite that much, but he still pocketed $5 million for 10 days of work, and those 10 days of work would involve three scenes. As it turned out, due to some complications one day, he was required to do an extra morning, but he decided to throw that in for free, because when you're getting $5 million, why wouldn't you? The other crucial piece of casting, though, was Joanne Galloway, the co-litigator alongside now Tom Cruise's Daniel Caffey. Now, Demi Moore writes about this film briefly in her memoir, and she learned from her agent, and she describes it as this, that she was a person of interest for the role of Joanne Galloway. She was not the only person of interest. Linda Hamilton, coming off the back of Terminator 2, she was considered and apparently auditioned. Jodie Foster, well, she was picking up an Oscar for The Silence of the Lambs, around this time. She got an Oscar for The Accused as well. She was reported to have auditioned as well. Michelle Pfeiffer had been considered. But in the case of Demi Moore, she was told she'd have to audition, which wasn't something ordinarily you'd imagine a star would would have to do. But then, I mean, in 1990, for instance, again, I've covered this before, she'd been one of the stars of Ghost, which had just been a gigantic hit. But conversely, she was coming to this particular project off the back of three box office disappointments. There was, for instance, Mortal Thoughts was one of them. Dan Aykroyd's directorial debut, Nothing But Trouble, was another. And then there was The Butcher's Wife, which is one of the few films in her memoir she says she actively regrets taking on. But she also says in that book she never had any problem with auditioning, with the idea of having to earn a part in a film. The only slight problem was she was 7 months pregnant when she went for her audition, and she went into the room opposite Tom Cruise. This was familiar as well, because she'd auditioned opposite Tom Cruise for the film Top Gun, with that particular role going to Kelly McGillis. But in this case, she landed the role of Galloway, and again, it brought the film even more star wattage. I mean, and you look at how it was fleshed out with the supporting cast as well. J.T. Walsh, the late great J.T. Walsh, an astounding character actor, but also names such as Kiefer Sutherland, Kevin Bacon, Kevin Pollock, these recognisable people. I mean, Wolfgang Bodison, I mean, it's a pretty well-known story, who plays Corporal Harold Dawson in this, was just someone who was bumped into in a corridor. I mean, there's a whole backstory in there. It's also worth noting that the ensemble was fleshed out with a couple of faces who would go on to be a little more famous: Noah Wyle, Cuba Gooding Jr., Xander Berkeley, all in the ensemble too. Joshua Malina was the only person who starred in the play who also landed a role in the film too. He would go on to do quite a lot of work with Aaron Sorkin. But the point being that this cast was coming together. One thing that wasn't coming together was cooperation from the Department of the Navy. And again, I mean, this article in Empire is really terrific, and it published an internal leaked memo from the Navy which explained its decision not to cooperate with the feature. I think you could get away with things like this in 1993. And I mean, just quotes from it: this script showed that the project did not comply with the Department of Defense requirements for full support, it read. And the portrayal of the principal Marine Corps character being particularly described as inaccurate and constantly negative. Now, the military, of course, had heavily cooperated with the making of Top Gun, and Top Gun, to some, was just seen as the best recruitment advert for the American military in the whole of the 1980s. Now, it's interesting in the memo that it noted this and said it didn't require every character to be a role model or a recruitment drive, but it did require balance, and the cooperation was thus denied to the film. That I believe the option was put for changes to Reiner and Sorkin, but Reiner wasn't having any of that. He would just, this was the film, this was the way it was going to be done, and on it went. Now, Reiner did still try use one or two tricks just to get a bit more military insight. He met on the quiet some Pentagon officials, and in fact, over 200 off-duty Marines were reportedly hired as extras for the film. Retired Marines came in as consultants as well, just to give it some authenticity too. But the film was coming together. It was going to be shot in the autumn of 1991. So rehearsals began in September, with filming beginning proper in October of that year. Now, that lack of military cooperation obviously affected where the movie was going to film. By this point, the budget was edging $35 million-ish, most of that on star salaries and director salaries as well. Because they obviously weren't going to film at Guantanamo Bay, and because they weren't going to film at US Navy institutions or any military installations, a lot of the film actually takes place on Hollywood sound stages, on studio backlots in the Los Angeles area. To be fair as well, a lot of the film takes place in a courtroom, perhaps not as much as you might remember, certainly I remembered, but nonetheless, it's a very indoorsy film for large part, and thus it could be done on a soundstage in a fairly straightforward way. Now, going to Jack Nicholson, I mean, if he only had three scenes in the film, which he did, he still made sure that the production got its full money's worth. So I played you a clip right at the start of this, of his infamous courtroom scene. I've kind of dialed back a couple of the spoilers in the full clip, but that was a scene that was shot over the course of a day or two. And because it was shot in a courtroom with a big cast, I mean, that's the other thing worth noting of this, that the courtroom sequence is towards the end of the film. There are lots of reaction shots and lots of contributions from lots of characters. And that meant that Nicholson's key scene had to be filmed from lots of different angles, which in turn meant that Nicholson had to sit in his seat and deliver that monologue again and again and again and again. And in fact, Reiner did say to him at one point, it's just like, aren't you getting tired? Isn't this a problem? He just said, and Nicholson reportedly said to Reiner, I don't usually get stuff this good. And he gave across that he was happy to do it. Apparently did it 40, 50 times in the end. And each time, and Cruise says this and Demi Moore says this, absolutely knocked it out the park. Cruise, in fact, was in awe of Jack Nicholson. I can't imagine he was the only one. And his contribution to that Empire article was stories of when he was young, how he and his friends would drive past Nicholson's house and want to knock the door when the light was on just to try and say hello to him or something like that. And so Cruise, when they're on the set of A Few Good Men, recounted this tale to Jack Nicholson. Nicholson replied that had they knocked the door, they were looking at the wrong house. It was, though, on the whole, said to be a happy shoot, this one. Lots of actors around, a director who knew what he was doing. I mean, I think it's Kevin Pollak who would give an interview saying this was as good a time as he'd ever had on a movie. One person it was tough on, though, was Demi Moore. That, again, she'd given birth not long before the filming of this. She'd worked her backside off to get into shape for the role. And she described her routine during the making of the movie, again in her book, where she talks about how she'd get up early, go for a long run, go to the set, hit the gym, feed the baby through the night. And she also talked about the fact that because she was breastfeeding while she was making the movie, she required regular help from wardrobe just to make elements of her costume equitable. I think I'm putting that delicately. But I wanted to raise that because we talk a lot about actors balancing a TV show and a movie. It's like story when we talk about Back to the Future or something like that. There's Michael J. Fox going from the set of Family Ties to Back to the Future and just working around the clock. Demi Moore was making a major Hollywood film and then bringing up, just nursing a newborn baby pretty much side by side. I think that's an effort and a half, in truth. The filming wrapped up on the movie towards the end of January 1992. And again, I mean, Reiner knew what he was doing. It went into post-production. The edit came together. But the problem that was facing A Few Good Men wasn't really just unique to that, because all of a sudden, with TriStar wanting to release the film at the end of 1992, there were two huge Jack Nicholson movies heading to US cinemas at the end of the year. At one point, they were both due at Christmas, pretty much the same time, because Nicholson had taken the lead in a biopic called Hoffa, the biopic of Jimmy Hoffa. We saw his life in Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, or at least one version of it. Hoffa had been directed by Nicholson's old friend, Danny DeVito, and both Hoffa and A Few Good Men, well, there was going to be Oscar buzz for both of those. And it was a question of which film would blink. Fox was behind Hoffa. A Few Good Men was TriStar, obviously, and the feeling was that the sheer extra star wattage of A Few Good Men meant that was going to win any battle. Also, Hoffa was a slightly more serious biopic-y film, slightly more dramatic one, and a little less audience-friendly. And it was indeed Hoffa whose release date moved by a couple of weeks and blinked first. Interesting, in the UK, I mean, A Few Good Men didn't arrive in the UK until early 1993, and another Nicholson film was programmed around the same time, one that had just been lost in the schedules a little bit, called Man Trouble, which came and went. But both in the US and the UK, there was a clash of the Nicholsons going on. A Few Good Men, then, by the time it came around to its premiere, which was December the 9th, 1992, I mean, this was just expected to be a big box office hit. And it certainly helped once the critics got their eyes on the final movie as well, because the acclaim reined in. There was, as is always the case, a little bit of pushback, but the talk was about Jack Nicholson's performance. But also, I think, about how Tom Cruise and Demi Moore pretty much go toe-to-toe with him in the movie, that... it was the performances in particular that were cited and hugely praised. And whilst there was some conversation about, is it actually a fairly conventional courtroom drama underneath it all, it was so glossy and entertaining, it was found pretty hard to resist. Audiences, well, they felt the same. The movie opened that week, the weekend of December the 11th to the 13th in the US, at number one. I mean, by this point, 35, 40 million to make. It opened with $15.5 million, which by 1992 standards, certainly Christmas standards as well, was strong. It knocked Home Alone 2 Lost in New York off the top slot where it had sat for the last 3 weeks. Also around at that point, The Bodyguard was on its third week. That went down to third. Disney's Aladdin was around for 5 weeks. That was in fourth. The Distinguished Gentleman, an Eddie Murphy vehicle. Really good one, actually, if you get a chance to seek that out. That was down to fourth place. The other new opener that weekend was the glorious The Muppet Christmas Carol. That was the only other film getting a wide release, which opened with a fairly modest $5 million, but we all know how wonderful that film is. Also going down the chart, there was just a small limited release for a really good John Sayles film called Passion Fish, which I'd recommend seeking out. But for the purposes of this, A Few Good Men was a hit, and it was a hit that was number one the week after as well, holding off competition from Robin Williams in Toys, Mel Gibson in Forever Young, Steve Martin in the underrated Leap of Faith. It was number one the week after as well, when Hoffa opened on Christmas Day in sixth place. A Few Good Men had had the lead on it. And so, I mean, eventually, it was only at the start of 1993, it was knocked off the top of the chart when Disney's Aladdin reclaimed the top slot. A Few Good Men would then take the top slot again the week after, and it would just sit around there for an awful long time, to the point where by the time its US run was complete, A Few Good Men had grossed $141 million. It had added another $100 million worldwide for nearly $250 million in takings for a courtroom drama on early 1990s money. But the acclaim wasn't done, because then in came the Oscar nominations. Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Best Film Editing and Best Sound Mixing. The Best Supporting Actor went to Jack Nicholson. And whilst it didn't take home any gongs, the one thing that has consistently endured about this film, and I re-watched it for this, I still think it stands up, but the one thing that's consistently endured is just the dialogue, and in particular the dialogue in one scene which has become part of modern popular culture and has been lampooned to bits over the years. A Few Good Men then, I mean, no sequel, the start of a run of I mean, it would be interesting, wouldn't it? A few more Good Men, something like that. But it would be a start of a run for Tom Cruise, which would just be enviable. That if you look at the films he would do in the aftermath of it, The Firm, which I'm coming to soon, Interview with the Vampire, coming to soon, the first Mission Impossible, Jerry Maguire, Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, Mission Impossible 2, those are the films that would take him to 2000. For Rob Reiner, oddly enough, his run would come to an end. He'd gone Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men. Then he did a really odd film with Bruce Willis in a bunny suit called North, which isn't a great movie. But he would then reunite with Aaron Sorkin for a film called The American President that, yep, I've covered before. And that in turn would lead to The West Wing. So not a bad collection of work there, really. And not a bad catalyst just off the back of one film. Which all brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. A couple of favours, if that's all right with you. I am an entirely 100% independent podcast producer. I sit in a room in the West Midlands, and the weather ain't great today as I'm recording this. The only reason I've got this far with this podcast, and I'm heading towards episode 200, which astounds me, and I can't thank you enough for tolerating me this long, is because of your support. If you do like this podcast, please do leave ideally a positive review at your podcast home of choice. If you can subscribe as well, all these things really help the algorithms and help us independents just at least get a foothold against, let's just say, much bigger alternatives. I also produce independent film magazines and a Blu-ray, which I've not gone on about yet, but I'm about to. You can order all of our magazines at store.filmstories.co.uk. That's both Film Stories magazine, which is pretty much monthly, and Film Stories Junior, which is for under 15s. I don't think there's a magazine quite like either, actually. And then we've got a Blu-ray of Sneakers out in the world now, packed with extras, including new extras as well that we've worked really hard to put together. You can buy all of these at store.filmstories.co.uk. Anything you can do to help spread the word is hugely appreciated. But I'm going to stop trying to sell you things now. I'm going to crack on with the second of the two episodes I'm talking about. Let's take a little trip to Springfield. We're moving to 2007. Play you a little clip from a trailer, and I'll come to the story the other side of this.
This summer, between honor and dishonor, between family and enemies, between July and August, a line will be drawn. And then colored in yellow.
Run! Run! Jump! Jump! Rest! Rest!
Now I know we've had a rough day, but I'm sure we can put all that behind us.
On July 27th, a secret will be revealed.
Look at that. You can see the four states that border Springfield: Ohio, Nevada, Maine, and Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
An empire will rise.
They have two buttons behind this desk.
That then is a clip from 2007's The Simpsons Movie, directed by David Silverman, screenplay by Deep Breath, James L. Brooks, Matt Groening, Al Jean, Ian Maxtone Graham, George Meyer, David Merkin, Mike Rice, Mike Scully, Matt Selman, John Schwarzfelder, and John Vitti, based on The Simpsons by Matt Groening, and starring Dan Castellaneta, Julie Kavner, Nancy Cartwright, Yeardley Smith, Hank Azaria, Harry Shearer, all on voicing duties. Albert Brooks is in there as well. And, well, I suppose The Simpsons doesn't really need an awful lot of introduction, does it? I mean, by the time the movie came round in 2007, the animated sitcom had become the longest running American sitcom of all time. It debuted in 1980. I know I just said it needs no introduction. This bit's really brief, honestly. It debuted in 1989. It didn't take long for the show, created by Matt Groening, to become not just a success, but also a cultural touch point. And I mean, it's interesting because at first it was all about, certainly for us in the UK, it was the character of Bart Simpson. And I remember the Do the Bartman single. Do you remember that? Crikey. I remember, I think it was Bart versus the Space Mutants computer game. I mean, it was Bart, 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 Bart. Then over time, the emphasis would shift to Homer, who took center stage. I mean, whatever. The point was, The Simpsons was one of those things that became huge and became huge pretty quickly. What it also was relentless, with television seasons coming round every year with 20 to 30 episodes in, and that afforded few gaps to do anything else for the creative team involved. Now, it wasn't shy of movie leanings with the references in there, but there was talk as The Simpsons went nuts on the small screen about bringing it to the big screen. I found an Entertainment Weekly article as early as 1991 where there was chat about a Simpsons movie at that point. And in fact, writer Mike Rice would eventually tell the website DVD Fanatic that by the time the film came around, it was 13 years of wanting to do so before Fox said yes. Now, there was a reason Fox held off saying yes. I'm going to come to that shortly. Because 20th Century Fox, the studio behind The Simpsons, had always been keen on doing a film. But the creatives behind The Simpsons, well, on the one, primarily at this point, they were struggling to fit it in. That the crew of the TV show was relatively slim, given the amount that they were pumping out. And as Groening would explain to the AV Club, he just said, the TV show's something we work on year round. So we don't have a staff of animators and writers and producers sitting around waiting for us to say go. He said, we're always working on the TV show. And it didn't seem that it was worth doing a movie unless we had a great story and could do something that justified people pulling a $10 bill out of their wallet. Now, that doesn't mean stories weren't discussed. I mean, there was an early episode of the show called Camp Krusty, and there was serious conversation at one point about turning that into a film, a kind of Lord of the Flies style story. But in the end, it took barely an hour for all the creatives at that stage to decide to focus on the TV show at that point. One of the creatives notably was producer James L. Brooks, who's been there right from the start at the inception of The Simpsons. Brooks has a background in films like Broadcast News, As Good As It Gets, and he would ultimately prove pivotal to the movie. I'm coming back to him. But across the 90s, I mean, even though there wasn't the impetus at that point to make a Simpsons film, it didn't stop the ideas coming. going. It's just they didn't really quite stick. The things weren't necessarily gelling together. But there was some momentum building towards it, and it got to a point where the voice cast of The Simpsons were offered lucrative new contracts in 2001. There was quite a bit of to and fro with the negotiation of that. And one of the things that Fox wrote into those contracts was a movie. That if you sign this deal for this amount of money for the TV show, you're also committing to do a film. Now, at that point, Fox hadn't greenlit a film. There wasn't a script for a film, but it was one of those moments where it was just like, no, if we're going to make this happen, we've got to do something. And so also what was happening by the early 2000s was the animation and writing teams of The Simpsons had grown enough to accommodate the additional work. Now, the key voice cast were committed and they were up for the film. But then it was a case of, well, if we've got all the personnel beefed up to deal with the TV side, how are we going to get the movie going? Who do we use? And they looked backwards. They looked to some of the founding faces of The Simpsons. So producer Al Jean and Mike Scully, they came on as producers. But also 10 writers from earlier years of The Simpsons were brought together to thrash out a script. And so I've read those names just before, but that's how they were recruited. They looked at some of the people who'd written some of the successful earlier episodes of the show or been involved with them and decided, we're going to bring all these people together, almost a brain trust, really, just try and get this going. Now, one person who was dealing with other brain trusts at that point was Simpsons alumnus Brad Bird. He'd made his first movie by this point, the beautiful animated film The Iron Giant, which I will come to in a future podcast. He'd then gone to Pixar and gone and become part, ultimately, of the Pixar Brain Trust, which is the group of directors and filmmakers against whom all projects are put and showcased. And so he'd made The Incredibles with Pixar, and he'd just taken on doing the film Ratatouille, which needed turning round. He was the replacement director on that, needed turning round in, 18 months? And so he was knee-deep in that. But the crucial turning point of The Simpsons movie was the deal that the creatives brokered with 20th Century Fox. And it was really a jump into, a risky jump from studio head at the time, a man called Tom Rothman. Because the deal that the creatives wanted, that Fox had always resisted, was that if they wrote a script, they had to have the option of abandoning the whole project if they weren't happy at any point with how it was going. Now, understandably, this raised some eyebrows at boardroom level. It's just like, what, a week before release, you're not happy, we're going to scrap the thing no matter how much we put in, you know? And so there was real pushback against it, and it was one of the sizable roadblocks to getting this film going. Fox eventually agreed to that. And it was a liberating moment, as James L. Brooks would describe. He just said, there was never the moment we were going to abandon it. We just kept on working because the fact we could say no meant that we never had to. And so work on the screenplay began in earnest, finally, in late 2003. And it wouldn't stop until like a couple of days before the film was ultimately locked. The way it worked was each of those 10, 11 writers would do a 20-page portion of the script, and then it was back to the production office on the Fox backlot to meld together the best of those ideas. Now, James L. Brooks was really stepping up and having a sizable part of this. And, I mean, it would be described that by the time the film was ultimately released, there had been hundreds of pages of rewrites, hundreds of them, loads of discarded ideas for a film that was ultimately 87 minutes long. But then, as Al Jean explained to Premiere magazine around the time of the film's release, the one thing we did not want to do, ironic because this was ultimately what he was criticised for, the one thing we did not want to do is make it look like three episodes strung together. He said we wanted to do something that really took 90 minutes to tell. And he said, I think it's safe to say that this is a story that merits big screen treatment. The creators also told Film Review magazine in its September 2007 issue that they love big movies. They wanted to make a film for that reason. And they wanted the bigger themes, the more intricate animation, the widescreen, shadows, lighting, all the things they didn't always have time to do in the show itself. They wanted to do in a movie. But I've jumped ahead, as I want to do. So let's go back to February 2004 at this point. And at this point, I mean, there's a whole series of articles across various issues of Entertainment Weekly I'm just drawing on here. And it was reporting in February 2004 that The Simpsons Movie was a go. It was going to be released in 2006, and series veteran David Silverman was to direct. Now, Silverman himself had been to other studios. He'd been to Pixar. He was one of the co-directors of Monsters, Inc. He'd been to DreamWorks. He was one of the co-directors of the sorely underrated The Road to El Dorado, one of just, I think, four hand-drawn animated films that DreamWorks made in the end. Or was it three or four? But Silverman knew. His argument was that when he was directing a TV episode, they could shower extra attention and little details on one or two scenes in every episode. With the film, he wanted to do that with all of them. And I mean, just the sheer number of touch points that were being cited. I mean, The Incredibles was a visual touch point for the creative team. The terrific Belleville Rendezvous, the French animated film from Sylvain Chomet, also known as Triplets of Belleville. They also cited a John Sturges film from 1955 called Bad Day at Black Rock, with Silverman saying it's a great education in staging because of how the characters are placed, although he did point out there are no gunfights in our movie. Now, the script was in a place where it could be presented to the cast in the first half of 2005. It'd be fair to say they were quite surprised to finally see a movie script after, 15 odd years of waiting for one. And the first table read of the script in that state took place in May 2005. Now, Entertainment Weekly would subsequently report that the film finally went into production in June of 2005. That was the point where 20th Century Fox had given this the green light. This was absolutely happening. It wasn't going to be a 2006 release anymore. The feeling was it was going to take 2 years from this point to bring to the screen, so a summer 2007 release. But, I mean, interestingly, the project was under a huge cover of secrecy, that plot details were not allowed to be leaked and were held under wraps till pretty much release time, and to the point where the recording sessions for the actors, the voice recording sessions, once they were done, the scripts were apparently shredded after each recording session that they did. The recording and the pre-production work was going on in the back end of 2005, and animation itself began in earnest in January 2006. They went for very much a cinematic widescreen format, the 2.4 to 1 ratio. They really wanted to, just beef up the film credentials of this. The animation was split between four different sites, a couple in California, and then another over in South Korea. The film recording sessions were going on, the cast voice recording sessions were going on pretty much every week, even as they came in and did their work on the TV show. They would come and do a little bit of work on the film. But with the animation beginning in January 2006, that gave them less than 18 months from that point to complete the movie, because Fox now wanted this in cinemas in July 2007. It was one of its big tentpole movies of the summer. And it was a race against time to finish the film that was constantly in flux. Again, a different Entertainment Weekly report. I bought more than one issue of this magazine. It talked about 24 staffers were in a trailer on the Fox lot working on the film with a digital clock above one workstation with a countdown on it. And it said the Simpsons, that countdown clock was, quote, when the Simpsons movie must be surrendered to the studio authorities. And they said, we use it as a means to frighten ourselves. And at the point the article was written, that countdown was at 16 days, 9 hours, 42 minutes, 6 seconds. And even at this point, less than 3 weeks before the film was handed over, the producers were still making changes. James L. Brooks was really, really hands-on with the making of the film and shaping the script, and kept evolving it even very, very, very much late in the day. The same with Matt Groening as well. I mean, by April 2006, it's worth noting, 3 weeks after 3 months after that animation had begun as well, I mean, there was no turning back, because Fox made the announcement that it would be in cinemas in July 2007, and it released a surprise, unexpected teaser trailer that itself had been put together under a huge veil of secrecy. That trailer went out with Ice Age the Meltdown, and Ice Age the Meltdown was huge, and lots of people around the world saw the trailer. trailer, the 20-second teaser for The Simpsons Movie, which was released simultaneously around the world as well. And at this point, Al Jean was saying, was describing the cast and how they brought everyone back. He said, we've also set Albert Brooks, Minnie Driver, the real Erin Brockovich. And he did point at that point. He said, you should be able to deduce the plot just from that information. And that's where rumours sprung up that this was going to have a kind of an environmental side to its narrative. As for Dan Castellaneta, the voice of Homer Simpson and assorted other characters in the film, he described the process this time as it's much more intense. And he told this to Rotten Tomatoes. He said, we did very long record sessions and Jim Brooks, James L. Brooks, was there to direct us. He said Jim was there at the very beginning when the show was airing and he directed a little bit. But for the most part, it was directed by one of the writers. This time, Jim has been there with Al Jean and Matt Groening to direct all of the voice sessions. It's been like working on a dramatic movie. Jim would stop the take. He'd say, remember, you really want this to happen. You're really sad about this. And it was an about turn, really, for how they were usually directed on the show. By the time we got to May 2007, then, which is what, 2 months before the release of the film, well, a piece in the New York Times described how they were still tinkering with the movie. Groening in that piece is quoted as saying, we've never been ahead of our deadline since the very beginning, talking about the TV show. They weren't on the movie either. He said at that point, it's also possible that sequences might still be rewritten or cut entirely before the film's July release, as indeed they were, because there were some test screenings going on, which I'll come to shortly. Silverman, though, he would praise the creative freedom that he'd had on this one. He said that Fox was hands-off. I mean, he'd come from Pixar, which was very hands-on. DreamWorks was under the stewardship, its animation division, of Jeffrey Katzenberg, a notorious Hollywood executive, for being very hands-on. And so, I mean, he would joke in the article in the New York Times, we started in November 2003, talked about the story for 6 months, wrote a first draft, and that has been rewritten at least 100 times right up to about a week ago. Nonetheless, the film was finally locked towards the end of May 2007 with an awful lot of material cut by that point. But even by that stage, there was this huge veil of secrecy over it. That in the run-up, there was snippets, there were trailers, but little known about the plot. But then Fox reasoned, what do you need to know? It's a Simpsons film. You go and see it because it's The Simpsons, which is fair reasoning, really. Groening, in the midst of all of this, just to make his workload a little bit more intense, he was juggling the release of the film and the post-production of the film with the revival of his TV show Futurama that Fox had cancelled, but now Comedy Central had picked up, and so he was involved in getting that back up and running, whilst also involving himself in the marketing of The Simpsons as well. Now, it actually got to the first critic screening without anyone outside of a small group of people seeing more than the first 10 minutes of the completed movie. There is a sequence in there as well, it's worth noting, where every single Springfield resident, Springfield being the town in which The Simpsons is set, makes an appearance, and it was at that particular moment reportedly needed up to around 3,600 individual drawings. They drew using Cintiq, so it went straight into a computer, but nonetheless quite a lot of just physical graft just to get sequences like that together. There were some test screenings, and off the back of those test screenings, the running time was trimmed back. And I mean, it was described that a test screening took place in Portland in Oregon. And the audience response was positive, a few criticisms. The producers made changes off the back of that. They lost a couple of secondary character moments. There were, in the end, nearly 100 speaking parts in the film. And they also took out an end credits gag in which, quote, resident aliens Kang and Kodos pick apart the film. They decided not to do that one in the end. But what they got to was the point where the film was actually finished. And, I mean, it would debut in Springfield, as you'd expect, on July the 21st, 2007. The response to it was, I mean, it was good. I mean, people like watching The Simpsons. I like watching The Simpsons. There was, I mean, the animation, the upgraded animation was noted. There was the criticism that it was effectively a couple of episodes, not back to back, which is a little bit harsh, but that was something that kept running through. But few were arguing about the level of entertainment in the film. That whilst one or two were just saying it didn't quite work, most people were pretty satisfied with what they got, considering what were you ultimately going to get when you move a 22-minute animated episode to an hour and a half. I mean, the South Park movie had been some degree of template for that. And in fact, The Simpsons would mirror some of the marketing techniques, as you heard in that trailer right at the start for South Park. But bottom line was, the film had come together after all this time, after nearly 20 years. It had cost $75 million to make at that point. It opened the weekend of July the 27th, the 29th in the US, and it shot to the top of the box office chart. $74 million opening weekend, knocking down the Adam Sandler headlined I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. That, you might remember, is the Sandler film where he marries a man and then surrounds himself with scantily clad women just so we wouldn't possibly think he'd want to marry a man in real life. I mean, there's a film. Also around at that time, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, my favourite of the Potter films. The Hairspray movie was down in fourth place. The new entry that weekend, though, was, I mean, it wasn't really a threat to The Simpsons. It was the film No Reservations, which didn't really do an awful lot of business. But The Simpsons movie certainly did. And by the time its box office run was done, it went through $500 million, of which, I mean, in the US alone, it was at $183 million. But this was also something, as the TV show had done, that travelled the world. It is, though, to this point, a standalone film, even though Fox had repeatedly requested a Simpsons movie too. But they're kind of back with the other problem that the television show was getting more and more ambitious and was requiring more and more human power to it, really. The latest on that was that, I mean, it was said to be in development towards the middle of 2018, that now that Disney owns Fox, that is likely to fast track at least some kind of Simpsons feature. Where it ends up in cinemas or on Disney Plus is unknown. It has reportedly slowed down because of COVID and because of the COVID era, as you might expect. But there are still plans for the Simpsons movie too. Thing is, because the first film took about 18 years to get to us, if it's following that pattern, it ain't going to be with us for at least another 3 or 4 years to come. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If you can tolerate any more of my waffle, you'll find me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You'll find the entire Film Stories project on Twitter at Film Stories Pod. We've got a website, filmstories.co.uk, which is updated every weekday with movie news, movie mayhem, reviews, features, all sorts of bits and bobs on there. Thank you for everyone who's visiting and spreading the word about that. I've already mentioned our shop. Why don't I do it again? store.filmstories.co.uk, magazines and Blu-ray, you'll find those available there. facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, we're there. youtube.com/filmstories, we're there. I will have news, hopefully, touch wood, that's some wood, you hear that, on some more live shows coming up shortly. But for now, the most important thing is you, as always. I thank you so much for lending me your ears and for lending me your time. You all stay safe and look after yourselves. I'm going to be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Bye bye.